Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Reclaimed, a podcast. Indeed. My name is William Bibbiani. I'm a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
Indeed, it is a podcast. My name is Whitney Seibold. People call me the Crypt Keeper. No, nobody calls me that.
Yeah! Oh, ow. Ooh, I got stitched in my side.
Oh, sorry.
I can't do my Crypt Keeper voice. It's
Welcome to Critically Resurrected. Critically Exhumed.
Critically Maimed was right there.
Critically
maimed.
Maimed.
Critically maimed. I pulled something in my side earlier today. It hurts to laugh.
This is the podcast where we put out polls to our listeners. We give you a poll of four films that one or both of us hasn't seen in the past.
From a particular streaming service, and we alternate regularly so that everyone gets a chance. Hmm. We put it to our patrons over patreon.com/criticallyclaimednetwork. You guys get to choose what we're going to review, and this week, a little late this week, sorry about that, lots of busy business things happening.
Oh, yes.
This week, we were going to the 1950s on the Criterion Channel, no shortage of great films from the 1950s in general, and certainly no shortage on the Criterion Channel, and you picked a film that I haven't seen since I was very, very small, and I guess Whitney had never seen. It is one of the most famous performances from one of the most famous performers ever.
Yeah.
And it is a film that is often revered as a comedy classic. And it is a film that, frankly, gave me the creeps a little bit when I watched it this time. Because there's some stuff we got to talk about. But let's talk about a film starring James Stewart and a 6-foot-tall invisible rabbit named Harvey.
Harvey with laughter and rousing applause. How do we know? Because for 5 long years, audiences did just that on Broadway for the most talked about Pulitzer Prize winning comedy of our time. And now at last, Harvey comes to the screen, better, richer, funnier than it ever was on the stage. Starring James Stewart as Elwood P. Dowd, America's most amiable citizen, with hilarious Josephine Hull and a grand cast. And once again, the critics are raving.
They might be giants.
Mm-hmm.
This is part of, I guess you could call it kind of a mini subgenre unto itself.
What's that?
Which is, it's a type of lighthearted comedy film about mentally ill people whose mental illnesses are seen as kind of a peculiar virtue.
Well, they're seen as inspiring.
Yeah.
In a way, where this person is experiencing some sort of mental health episode. They believe in something fantastical. Miracle on 34th Street is another example. Here's a guy who believes he's actually Santa Claus. And the whole idea is the world possibly a better place for people having benevolent delusions?
Yeah. Which is something that Frank Capra, I think, that's you can't take it with you. Like, these people live by this really kind of bizarre sort of code.
I think it's more of a milder version of that, but they're just like outcasts and don't care about what society thinks. And
there's a
good
film,
for them.
There's a film called They Might Be Giants. It's where the band got their name, about George C. Scott, who believes he's Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
And and I had another example.
K-Pax.
Oh, there you go.
That was a movie from the 90s about someone who may or may not be an alien.
There was one called Happy Accidents with Vincent D'Onofrio and Marissa Tomei, where he said he was a time traveler.
Yeah. And they're not all good. I mean, there's like Almost an Angel, where Paul Hogan is like a bank robber who thinks he's been saved by Charlton Heston as God. And so now he has to try to do miracles, but he might just have had like a vision and a near-death experience.
I saw one called, I think that it was the one where Jeff Goldblum thought he was Jesus Christ.
Jeff Goldblum thought, you mean Holy Man with Eddie Murphy?
No, Jeff Goldblum.
Okay.
He was a starving homeless man, and his photographer like posed him on a cross.
Oh, I don't
know
this one.
Like as a crucifix, and he started to think that he was Jesus Christ.
This one I don't know. I think
that might have been The Favor, the Watch, and The Very Big Fish. But
I don't know that one. I was thinking of this is a movie that subverts the premise, and I think it's a Peter Medak film called The Ruling Class.
Great
movie starring Peter O'Toole as a British aristocrat who inherits a title, but he thinks he's Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And they spend so much time trying to convince him that he's not Jesus Christ that they don't consider the possibility that maybe what he actually is worse. Mm-hmm. That's a very bitter comedy, that one. Mm-hmm. And so Harvey didn't invent this, and Harvey would become kind of a mini classic of the genre. But what's interesting about Harvey is that although on the surface this appears to be a story of a very kindly man, he's a functioning alcoholic, but he doesn't seem to get in any serious trouble from it. Everyone likes him. He's very decent. But he doesn't pretend that he isn't talking to an invisible 6-foot-tall rabbit. Mm. And he will tell anyone who's listening that this is a real person next to him right now. You just can't see him. Well, and everyone around him either thinks that he is completely lost his mind and needs to be committed, or he is utterly harmless and totally sweet. But what the film decides very early on is Harvey is real. And that's why this isn't quite part of that genre for me.
And
One of the first things that happens when they take him to an asylum is they find Harvey's hat, which is a hat with ear holes cut out. Mm. And sometimes Harvey will open doors and things, you know?
Yeah, I forgot when it was, like, physically confirmed, like, that Harvey was able to manipulate the real world.
I think it's when I saw the hat, that's when it got me. I'm like, there's no way that James Stewart snuck that in somewhere. Yeah, he's not being duplicitous. He's not trying to trick anyone.
James Stewart, he plays a character named Elwood Dowd, and Elwood is established early on as an alcoholic.
Yeah.
He's always in bars, and he's drinking heavily and toasting people, and he's always a little bit tipsy.
Yeah.
So it could be that Harvey is a hallucination.
Yeah, yeah.
That he's drunk so much that he's starting to hallucinate this rabbit, which is something you'd see in, like, Dumbo cartoons.
Sure.
You know, whole pink elephants on parade sort of thing.
Yeah.
This is kind of a condemnation of mental health in a mental health organization in the United States.
Especially in the mid-20th century. We like to think of, and listen, psychology and therapy have done wonders for my life. I cannot pretend otherwise. Psychology wasn't always great. And in fact, a lot of times in this country, psychology was a deeply fucked up institution where people could have family members committed for next to no reason, and often would, just if they were inconvenient, particularly if they were women. It was an extremely sexist institution. What took a shocking amount of time for people, for example, like homosexuality, to be taken off of the books as some sort of mental illness.
I think they finally took that out of, like, psychological problem books as late as, like, the late
70s. I heard it was later than that, but my point is way too fucking late.
Yeah. There's a pretty good film out there called The Mountain, which is about this very thing, about men who are committing the women in their lives just to essentially get them out of their
lives. Also
stars Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah. There's a really good film called The Dangerous Method, directed by David Cronenberg.
It's about Freud and Jung.
About Freud and Jung. Jung is played by Michael Fassbender. Freud is played by Viggo Mortensen. And Keira Knightley plays a woman who is his quote-unquote hysterical. But what they both come to realize over time is, no, she's just depressed. She's living with horrible, systematic oppression, and it would affect anyone's personality after a while.
Hysteria is another one of those weighted words that was often applied to women who were being committed.
Yeah.
They're being committed for hysteria.
Which is basically a coverall for the men in their lives would find them inconvenient.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's an interesting
a footnote. There's a film called, it's either Hysteria or Hysterical with Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Yeah, I think it's called Hysterical. Yeah.
And the idea is women who are suffering from hysteria, their prescription was masturbating.
Yeah.
And it's about the woman who...
It's Hysteria, 2011. Hysteria, yeah.
And about the woman who invented vibrators.
Yeah.
As this sort of, like, psychological cure-all. It was, like, tied in with that. Yeah.
So the idea
that, you know, we can't assume that we've, you know, sort of reached the plateau when it comes to psychology. It's constantly evolving.
So there's two schools of thought kind of on the plot of Harvey, because the plot of Harvey is really quite simple. Elwood Dowd lives with his sister and his niece. His sister and his niece have had it up to here with this Harvey guy. They are embarrassed to be seen in public. His niece... what's her name?
It was Myrtle, wasn't it?
I believe it was, yeah, Myrtle. Yeah,
Myrtle, played by Victoria Horne.
Yeah, Myrtle is young and wants to meet men and get married and live her life, and she can't do that with a guy in the house who was talking to rabbits. It's ruining her chances at being part of society. You could say that that's stuck up if you, all you want, but it is driving them to the brink. And so they decide early in the film to have Elwood committed. Now, at this point, the movie could take a variety of different turns, and it kind of tries to have its cake and eat it, too, where it's portraying psychology as kind of benevolent, but also inherently corrupt, because when his sister arrives to...
Vita, played by Josephine Hall,
who won an Academy Award for this.
Yeah, and she's great.
She's funny.
She's like in... Not Margaret Hamilton.
Margaret Dumont
Overdrive.
Yeah. That sounds like a great cover band.
Margaret Dumont Overdrive.
It's Bachman Turner Overdrive, but it's all Margaret Dumont's.
Yeah, she goes to the local psychological office and sanitarium, essentially, and she wants to have Jimmy Stewart committed.
Yeah, so
she's so overwhelmed and so...
She's having a panic attack, basically.
So panicky when she's describing Harvey to the psychiatrists that they think she's the one who's been seeing Harvey.
Yeah, and when they find out...
They immediately have her committed and take her upstairs, and they horrendously mistreat her.
But
it's not on camera, but she
relates
it later.
They rip her clothes off, and they're going to bathe her against her will. And, and meanwhile, they fight
freezing cold water.
And meanwhile, at her behest, they had already committed Elwood. And when they find out that Elwood has been imprisoned, they're like, "Oh my god, he could sue us for $1 million. We could sue us into oblivion. We have to get him out of here, Mr. Elwood. We're so sorry that we ever assumed for one moment that a man could have mental health problems. Clearly, it was your sister who had mental health problems this whole time." And they're so wrapped up in giving him the speech that they don't notice that he is constantly trying to introduce him to his friend, Invisible Rabbit. And it takes forever. This is based on a play, and you can tell because there's very extended sequences. Most scenes last a really long time. It doesn't feel like it. It feels like a movie. It never feels like they're avoiding going to any locations. It always feels like it needs to be is where it needs to be. But so on one hand, this is a horrifying story about how intensely fucked up and corrupt and sexist psychological institutions are. On the other hand, everyone there's still kind of nice, and they all get happy endings, and it's kind of sweet. And I'm like, I'm watching this movie, and I haven't seen this since I was a kid. And when I was a kid, the narrative about this movie, Harvey, was that it's nice. It's sweet. It's about a guy who sees a rabbit, and the rabbit's probably real, and it's super cute, and you're all going to have a good time. Everyone's going to have a good laugh at this. And I'm watching it now, and I'm like, this would make a great double feature with The Exorcist, where it's all about how science has very serious limitations when it comes up against the fantastic.
Harvey is a Pooka, which reminds me of a pair of films I saw. One is called Pooka, and one is called Pooka Lives.
Yeah.
Which...
they actually use the term Pooka. It's the earliest movie I've ever heard use the term Pooka, which is an older...
It's like a Celtic myth about this sort of, like, talking rabbit.
Or talking animal, really. Like, humanoid animals, basically.
Okay. The movie Pooka is more about, like, a Furby craze. It's just this rabbit monster. Yeah. Whereas the sequel is about... how the monster itself begins to mutate as it spreads as a meme online. Well, it's a little bit bizarre.
The idea isn't so much that, because in folklore, a pooka is more specifically a humanoid animal that may talk to you, that may be benevolent, may be a trickster. In Pooka Lives, which is quite good, actually, it's a thought form.
Yeah.
So that if we believe in it, it becomes real. And if we believe different things about it, those different things become real. So if you believe that it's harmful, it is. And if you believe that it's not, it isn't.
And because of the nature of the internet, people start spreading word that it's harmful. So it just gets worse and worse.
Yeah.
Somewhat clever movie, I think. Not a peerless classic, but worth watching.
No, definitely worth seeing.
Harvey is a pooka. And late in the film, Elwood tells a story of how he first met Harvey. Mm-hmm. How he had staggered out of a bar And he was helping an even drunker friend home. I'm assuming he was also drunk.
Probably.
Yeah. He doesn't say he was intoxicated, but that's the sense I got from the story. But yeah, he was accompanying another drunk friend home, saw him away, and turned and saw leaning up against a lamppost Harvey.
A giant rabbit.
Giant rabbit. And just said, how you doing there? And how he kind of gave Harvey his name, which implies that Harvey is an invention of his own brain, but at the same time, we do get to see things happening around him where Harvey appears to be manipulating things. There's another possibility here.
Yeah.
And this is something I took from The Exorcist.
What's that?
Specifically the book. That James Stewart is projecting Harvey. He's not real. But he's also manipulating these things with his mind.
So he's somewhat psychic.
Yes.
Okay.
That he actually has, like, these psychic powers. A big part of The Exorcist is, you know, if this young girl, like, looks at a drawer and it opens on its own, that's not necessarily proof that it's supernatural.
Because theoretically telekinesis is possible.
Telekinesis is kind of on the books, so we can't immediately discount that this is a psychokinetic phenomenon. It's still extraordinary, but that's not necessarily proof of a demon.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm thinking something similar might be happening with Harvey.
That's an interesting motif.
That Harvey is a hallucination of his, and he's manifesting this hallucination with his own psychic powers. It's more like Exorcist. Maybe Carrie might be the more appropriate analogy.
I would just like to say that this is a 1950s comedy about a giant rabbit, and we've already compared it to, like, The Exorcist and A Dangerous Method, and there's a lot going on here, and I was actually pleasantly surprised to see, like, how much depth this movie at least touches upon.
I appreciate that it is a criticism of modern psychological practices. The character, the most boring character of the movie is Dr. Lyman Sanderson. He's played by an actor named Charles Drake. Yeah. A milk carton of a man. He's just square, boring, full of dullness. And and I like milk. But he is the one who, he's sort of like the dashing Dr. Kildare kind of hero type.
The lead nurse at the mental institution is in love with him, but he's oblivious or doesn't care.
And he seems to be like a step off all of the other characters. Every other actor knows they're in a comedy, and this guy's just sort of playing it kind of straight.
But on the other hand, his job in the plot is to be that stick in the mud. His job is to be obtuse to people's emotions. It's his job
in a funny way.
Perhaps, but I'm saying at some point someone might have told him, you will not be the likable person in this movie.
Yeah.
That's your job, is to take one for the team. You are got to be overwhelmingly, annoyingly obtuse in order for the plot to work. And he might have taken that too far. That's possible. Because he is a plank. He's just a big old block of wood just standing in everybody's way, and he's got to get around him. Over the course of the film, Elwood disappears, goes to a bar. Harvey disappears, goes to another bar. It's entirely possible that when they finally arouse the head of the mental institution, when he's finally going to step out of his office and do something, and he goes to see Elwood and Harvey, they all disappear for a while. And what we find out is, apparently, the head of the psychological institute can see Harvey, too. He's completely convinced Harvey is real. He's, like, right off the bat. He's like, Well, then, yeah. He's a fucking rabbit. You're 100% right. Whoops. And his life has changed. Something fantastic has happened. And that's something that I think is actually really, really sweet here. The idea, the possibility that something fantastical can happen is something that is enriching to, like, the human spirit that we see here.
That something fantastic happens, and we realize that if something fantastic happens to you, it's not going to crush your worldview. It's actually this very benevolent thing that inspires you.
Yeah, and what I love about Harvey as a concept. I mean, there's conflict because will Elwood be committed? But the existence of a supernatural creature, and this is something you just don't see enough today. The existence of a supernatural creature doesn't mean, Elwood Dowd has been summoned for the Great Pooka War, he's the great chosen one. No. It just turns out that there are some fantastical things out there, And they're nice. And my favorite...
I'm trying to think of the last... this is another... like, E.T. follows this conceit. Yeah. It's that there's a fantastical creature, and it helps you, and it's great. Yeah. And it's kind of your secret, and it's your friend, and then it goes away.
Totoro is another great example. Yeah,
Totoro is great. Yeah. I'm trying to think of the last movie I saw where Earth to Echo, which is sort of a riff on E.T.
Oh, very much so, but a very good one. Very underrated film, I think, Earth to Echo.
Same with, what was the J.J. Abrams one?
Oh, Super 8. That one was a little bit more monstrous, but it turns out it's just misunderstood.
That's also kind of a Spielberg thing. There haven't been too many films about kids who find an extraordinary thing, and it becomes just this miniature benevolent thing that helps just them, which might be why I responded so well to Psycho Gorman.
Yeah.
Because Psycho Gorman is Harvey, isn't it? It's about these kids who discover this benevolent thing, but it turns out it's actually like the most malevolent being on the planet.
What if Winnie the Pooh but Thanos?
Exactly.
Like that's kind of what that movie is, and that's totally the vibe.
Oh, we found this delightful creature, but it turns out it's this genocidal alien creature.
And if you think about it, like, you know, some people talk about how the protagonist of Psycho Gorman is this absolute monster of a child. But here's the deal. Christopher Robin needs Winnie the Pooh. What does this monster child need? Thanos. That's what the child needs. But what I like about this, and what I like ultimately about Harvey, and this is something that this is a speech that... James Stewart gives, and I'm gonna quote it verbatim here because I really do think this is kind of my philosophy. Mm. He said, years ago, my mother used to say to me, she'd say, "In this world, Elwood, you must be," she always called me Elwood. "In this world, Elwood, you must be oh so smart or oh so pleasant." Well, for years I was smart. I recommend pleasant. You may quote me. Now, my personal philosophy is there's no reason why you can't be both.
Right.
But pleasant is something that I feel like we've lost. We've lost pleasant. Nice and moral, sure. But pleasant? There is a serious dearth of pleasantry, I feel like, in the world today. And maybe I haven't always been best at keeping up my end of that bargain. Mm. But... ultimately, what I feel Harvey espouses is, hey, if we could all be relaxed and groovy, there's so many problems we could solve if we were just relaxed and groovy. And I feel like if you were made Harvey today, the biggest difference in the movie would be Elwood would not be a drunk. He would just be high all the time. It would just be Seth Rogen.
Well, I'm trying to think what the modern version of Harvey would be, because this kind of movie isn't quite made anymore.
Not for adults, anyway, yeah. I mean, like, we had Donnie Darko was a riff on this, and it was like this extremely insidious and creepy and very, very dour.
I'm thinking would be, well, I mean, Donnie Darko came at a time when, you know, there was a lot of sort of millennial angst was going on at the time. There's all this apocalyptic talk and time travel and all this extraordinary things. I do like the film Donnie Darko.
It's fine. It's not for me. It's not my favorite.
I know that it has like this huge following. But I think this sort of story inspires a little bit of cynicism. This idea that we need something very literal to be explained to us.
Yeah.
That we can't sort of accept, perhaps, that Harvey can be real and also not real. Mm-hmm. And that's actually not the point of the movie. The point of the movie is to be a pleasant human being.
Yeah, and that's true for his family as well. You don't have to believe in Harvey to be pleasant about someone who does.
So either it would be incredibly explicit that the James Stewart character is mentally ill and needs to be cured of Harvey, as it were, and the movie would actually start delving into that and, like, follow him into therapy and actually sort of see him out on the other end once he's no longer living with Harvey.
Mm-hmm.
Or it would be something a little bit... it would state outright that he was supernatural, but we'd also have to get to know Harvey's motivation and this and why Harvey itself, this creature, appeared to him, and it would, like, connect to... space aliens or international.
You're saying the temptation would be irrestistible to overexplain it.
Exactly. That's kind of the mold of a lot of modern fantasy.
Or you do that thing that, like, Steven Spielberg's Hook did or Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland did, which is just like, yes, Harvey is the vague backstory, and now we're going back after Elwood has emerged from
Elwood is now an elderly man and reunites with Harvey years later, and that
it's all kind of cynical but also sweet. Yeah. Just tell the story.
Harvey is older now, and
I look at
Harvey's been Harvey's been living with his enemy.
Yeah.
I look sometimes I look sometimes at the movie Hook. And, you know, I was in the age demographic to love Hook. I didn't love Hook. I love Dustin Hoffman in Hook. I didn't love Hook. Because I kept looking at Hook and I kept thinking to myself, why didn't Spielberg just do Peter Pan? We're not really getting anything out of the idea that, like, dad got really obsessed with business and needs to find his childhood again. That's every family movie. That's the most generic fucking thing in the world. You had Spielberg
even
at the
in
height
91
of,
it was yeah, already a cliche.
You had Spielberg at the height of his powers, at the height of his budget, able to do anything he wanted. Visual effects had caught up with him. Why didn't you just do Peter Pan? You were perfect for Peter Pan. Why did you do the weird 90s Tim Allen dad version of Peter Pan? I never got it. Like, it always struck me as kind of a waste. I don't see what that story needed to be told. It always felt like, you know, just kind of desperation move.
There's just a lot of deconstruction going on at the time. And, you know, rather than just do a straight up Peter Pan movie again, they said, let's do something a little more interesting.
Make it modern. What would Neverland look like now?
Nothing changes in Neverland.
Well, yeah, but like different kids would be coming in and bringing their influence, right? Their imaginations are becoming real. I mean, that's kind of what we got with the Lost Boys in this version. Anyway, with their mohawks and their skateboards and stuff like that. Let's do that.
All right.
If you must have Rufio, and you must. He's the best part of that movie besides Dustin Hoffman. Like, how do we never get a Rufio spinoff?
Yeah, only... Didn't he die saying, I wish I had a dad like you?
He did, didn't he?
Yeah, Rufio died and said something stupid right before he died.
That's right, what a waste! You monsters!
Live on cake frosting. Hook sucks, by the way.
Hook is not great.
Hook is not a good movie.
I know a lot of people love Hook. I get why you love Hook. I don't agree.
It's slick. It's got a lot of charm, but golly, it's a bad movie.
Bumping the table. Anyway, back to Harvey.
But Harvey, I think, another film I can compare it to is Frank Capra's Arsenic and Old Lace.
Mm. Mm.
Because Arsenic and Old Lace is also... It's about these kindly old aunts who are actually serial murderers.
Like Harvey.
Harvey, who poisons people. No, the idea that... are we going to let this continue?
Uh-huh.
This weird... And there's
just
sort of these
nice
outsider characters who are like the ones who are panicking, whereas... The kindly old aunts, or Jimmy Stewart, are kind of just very kind people.
And they keep talking about, we only kill people who were, like, old and lonely and had nothing to live
for.
They
think they're doing something very benevolent with all of this. Of course, they're committing murders, the same thing.
You're talking about a situation where we're taking this philosophy to its logical extreme and then crossing the line.
Yeah.
So, yeah, fair enough. I'm not saying we should take this... It's like this idea that because Hannibal Lecter is so damn appealing and polite, we like him... No, he's a monster. I remember when I watched Hannibal, the series, with a friend of mine, and I loved it and I recommended it to them. And at first they were really, really into it because the first part of that show, it's all about how Hannibal Lecter met Will Graham before Will Graham found out Hannibal Lecter was a serial killer. They kind of befriended each other. Hannibal Lecter became Will Graham's psychologist, and they solved serial killer murders together, which is a fun weekly whodunit kind of vibe. And then gradually over the course of the first season, you realize that Hannibal Lecter is manipulating Will Graham's therapy in order to take advantage of him and convince him that of false realities.
Because Will Graham has superpowers in that show.
No, he's just incredibly intuitive. That's all. They treat it like a superpower because it's fun, but it's just he's incredibly intuitive. It's like saying Hannibal Lecter is a superpower. No, he's just smart. That's it. That's a superpower in this universe. But in any case, has a superhuman sense of smell. I'll give you that. He's got Wolverine's nose,
and he has like a spider sense with other serial killers.
Yeah, he knows. They always know when they're in the room. They just lock eyes.
Oh, you're a serial killer too. What do? Oh, I make violins out of corpses. Oh, funny. I make instruments out of bones as well.
Mm. Now we must kung fu fight. And then they do. They do an awesome kung fu fight scene.
I turn them into sauce. It's like...
It's fun. Anyway, my point is this.
Such a stupid show.
I think the show knows it's camp. I think you cut a little bit more slack. But anyway. But I was watching the show and I was with them. I was rewatching with them. And Once they started seeing that Hannibal Lecter was manipulating Will Graham, they said, I don't like Hannibal anymore. And I'm like, I don't think you were supposed to.
Oh, like the character?
Yeah, like, I think you're not supposed to, like, he's a charming devil, but he's still the devil. Mm. I don't think we're supposed to want to hang out with him.
He's Hannibal Lecter. He's a cannibal. He's a serial killer.
We all like to think that because, like, Clarice Starling cracked the code, and it's just like, if you're polite to him, he won't kill you because it would be rude. Mm. That we'll all be in his good graces. No, he thinks nothing of us. He's a monster. Just like Elwood, of course. Elwood would feed everyone to Harvey if in a heartbeat.
I admire that the film didn't bother to, like, it did explain Harvey.
Yeah.
But it was all explanations from Elwood. So it was
maybe not a reliable narrator. Yeah.
And if you want to take Elwood's word for it, you can. And if you want to see Elwood as somebody who does suffer from these hallucinations, but has brought no harm to the world because of them, just let him live. Mm-hmm. This is a live and let live kind of movie. It has a very gentle philosophy.
Yeah.
All of the aggressive people who are trying to imprison him, mm-hmm. all come about a horrible end, or they sort of are shown the error of their ways.
Yeah, there's this great thing. It all leads to this wonderful climax where Elwood is informed in no uncertain terms, because he was kind of hazy on, like, how miserable his family was, that he's ruining his sister's and his niece's life. Mm-hmm. And they're just like, yeah, this Harvey thing has really ruined our standing in the neighborhood. And although over the course of this film, your niece has begun dating the guy who kind of attacked her mom in the institution, and we're never really going to deal with that. But regardless, even though things are kind of working out right now, they all say, like, yeah, this whole Harvey thing has kind of ruined the family, and we'd kind of wish that wasn't a thing anymore. And Elwood's like, well, there's nothing I can do. And they say, no, we could give you, like, a serum, like a
shot.
It's a MacGuffin, but basically, basically, like, if you take these pills, you will stop hallucinating. And he says, okay, I'll do it if it'll make you happy. That's really important to me. You're my family. I care. And he goes to get the shot. And then this guy comes in. There's this recurring gag about how there's, like, a cab that's waiting outside. It's been waiting for forever. And the guy talks about how, oh, you're gonna give him a shot? Oh, that's too bad. He was really nice on the way over. People are always really nice on the way over to this place. And when they come back, they're always assholes. And his sister realizes that what she's asking from Elwood isn't for the rabbit to go away, but for him to change. And she likes him the way... The rabbit is annoying.
Oh.
But she likes her brother the way he is because he's a nice guy. He's a good person. He cares.
Let me look up the name of that actor.
You played the cab driver?
The cab driver.
Okay.
Because his speech is the crux of the movie, and he's not even a major player in the
movie. No, he's a really, really small part, but he gets to come in and just kind of lay everything out. It's a wonderful gift to a small performer.
Yeah, this guy, the character is named Henry. He's played by an actor named Norman Leavitt. And he's not a key player. He only shows up in this one scene. He's just a cab driver.
Yeah.
And he doesn't have, like, the air of the divine about him. Like, he's sent to give this message.
No.
He's just, I've driven a lot of people. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are jerks. He's not. Bye. Yeah. And it's that sort of outsider perspective that the character needs.
Yeah, a lot of times screenwriters will try to hide that character in the movie for, like, a long time. Like, here's someone who doesn't have much to say or is always around. And then at the end, they get to, like, because they've been an outside observer, Silent Bob will lay out the entire plot. Or the grandmother from Parenthood will have that great speech about the merry-go-round versus the roller coaster. Mm. And that works, too. But the audacity of having someone who has nothing to do with the plot just come in and just be like, hey, here's what everyone's missing.
Here's the theme of the movie. Okay.
Bye.
And he's not, and again, he's not played by, like, some wizened character actor. Like, you remake it and they get Tom Hanks to come in and play the cab
driver. Someone really important to let you know that this is an important character.
Oh, we have to listen to this guy.
Yeah.
No, it's just some guy.
Yeah.
The temerity and the boldness that takes to put all of the themes of the movie on the shoulders of this completely unknown character. And he's directed as if he just had... He probably only read his scene.
Yeah.
He didn't even necessarily read the rest of the movie. Oh, I don't know.
I don't know. They might have cast people from the play.
Actors like to do it in different ways. But it's possibly as one of those actors who like to read just his lines and not the rest of the movie. Because some characters like to sort of have their characters sort of exist in their own world.
I mean, I've said this before. I think one of the earmarks of a great screenplay is that every role, no matter how small, has a character.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean they have to have a lot to do. Doesn't mean they have to steal a scene or a moment. It just means that they are not there just to be there or to push the plot forward. They are a human being who has thoughts and opinions and cares about that. I think the ultimate example of this, and it's a character from a movie from Your Boss, so I know you can't say much about it, but for me, the ultimate example of this is Steve Buscemi in Pulp Fiction.
Okay.
Because Steve Buscemi plays a waiter who dressed as Buddy Holly.
Oh, that's right. He's in the 50s diner.
He's in the...
Jack Rabbit Slims.
And that's it. He comes in, and it's Steve... He's kind of hidden, so like you don't necessarily recognize that it's him. But once you know it's him, you're like, why is Steve Buscemi playing this nothing character? And you realize it's because that's a real character. Hmm. He hates his job. That's it. He comes in, he hates his fucking job. Uh-huh. And that's it. That's the whole thing. But there is a world of hatred. You can picture him coming to this place over and over again. And he probably tried dating some of his co-stars of the thing. And it didn't work out. And he gets paid like shit. Just miserable. And no one tips him because he's just Woody. He's just Buddy Holly. And like the Marilyn Monroes and the Mamie Van Dorens are getting like all the money. And it's just like, it just sucks. It just sucks to be that guy. And he has like two lines.
That's a very similar role went to Janine Garofalo in the movie The Cable Guy, the two main characters, Matthew Broderick and Jim Carrey, go to Medieval Times.
Yeah.
And she's the waitress at Medieval Times.
Yeah, very similar bit, yeah. And you already know, it's Janine Garofalo.
Yeah, so
she was already a famous comedian by that point.
She comes traipsing in, and you recognize Janine Garofalo, and Matthew Broderick is eating his chicken with his bare hands. Like, do you have any flatware? And... you can see how many times she's said this to somebody.
Yeah.
Like, just sort of looks at him and with complete stony gravestone expression. There was no flatware in Medieval Times, so there's no flatware at Medieval Times.
Was there a Pepsi in Medieval Times? And she's like, so much. Shut up.
And then the entire earth ignites because of her rage.
But that's this movie. Every single small role in this movie feels like a big role.
Well, and I think there's a theatrical, because it's based on a play, there's this theatrical element to Harvey that I think works in its favor.
Yeah.
Where everything is very talky and everything's very stagey and the characters aren't afraid to be a little big. Which fits when, you know, Jimmy Stewart is doing kind of a big version of a Jimmy Stewart character. That kind of like, aw shucks, innocent kind of character. Which he played so well. That was kind of his trademark.
Yeah.
So all of the emotions play a little bit larger, but we're not dealing with a big story. What's playing large is the calm, if you will.
Yeah. Because the calm is flying in the face of all the manic humor the movie would have.
And the calm and the gentleness is larger than you would have in something that was a little bit more cinematic or scripted.
He's a wonderful comic foil, Elwood Dowd, because nothing phases him. He's not a fool.
Yeah.
He's not really paying attention a lot of the time, and he doesn't really understand everything going on around him, but... because nothing phases him, even when everyone else is super intense and cares, it's almost a Buster Keaton bit.
Yeah.
Where he's just completely stone-faced and pleasant and everything's nice while everyone else freaks out around him. And he just comes across as more and more Christ-like with every passing scene because, and it's mostly Josephine Hull, is just at the edge of her damned robe. Mm. Apparently Jimmy Stewart had... something to say about Jimmy Hull's performance. Said she had the hardest role in the movie because she has to not believe in Harvey and believe in Harvey at the same time.
Yeah.
Because the existence of Harvey is driving her mad because she doesn't believe in the existence of Harvey.
Right.
But he is an actual factor in her life. It's such a horrible contradiction to have to keep in your head actor.
I'm a parent. My child is six, and it's sort of like knowing sort of the inner workings of your child's in jokes, the kinds of things that your kid says that only you as the parent can really understand, or somebody who's lived with that kid can understand. She's lived with him, and there's nothing really dark in Harvey, but there's something to be said for the experience of somebody who lives with someone with mental illness and getting to know that mental illness really, really well.
And there's an implication that this has something to do with grief Elwood stayed home to live with his mother. He never married. He never really pursued much of a career for himself. And shortly before the beginning of the film, and just before he met Harvey, his mother died.
Yeah.
And that's why his sister and his niece moved in with him. So one could argue that grief, there's that dark undercurrent there too.
Yeah.
That Harvey exists, either he showed up as a magical creature to Elwood because Elwood needed a friend right now, or Elwood concocted him because he was lonely.
Yeah.
And even if he is living with his sister, they're not on the same wavelength. He doesn't have anyone like that. And it is very, very sad. Mm-hmm. James Stewart considered this his favorite role. It's easy to see why.
He's great in it.
So good.
I've seen a lot of Jimmy Stewart movies, and I think Mr. Smith Goes to Washington is one of the best of all films, really. But here he gets to play such an interesting character. He's a character you want to look at. He is such an appeal. Elwood is such an appealing character because you want him to live with Harvey. You admire the relationship he has with Harvey. And you like that he is going from place to place, just brightening things up.
Yeah.
Whether or not he is mentally ill, whether or not he is having hallucinations, we like him from the start. And we kind of want to hang out with this guy. And your sympathies are instantly with him. So when all of these people who are saying, this is for the best, we're going to change this about you, we are on his side. We want to just sort of ignore it and continue on the way he's continuing on.
Yeah, because we see how harmless he is, and we see how happy he is.
And the film ends letting him be happy. Mm.
There was apparently some debate while they were making the film of whether or not to ever show Harvey. They actually show Harvey.
There's a painting of Harvey.
There is a painting of Harvey, which suggests, and there's a good line, I think Jimmy Stewart, it's actually his sister has about it, which is a picture will show you what things are, like a painting will show you like the soul of it.
Yeah.
And so she doesn't realize that she's referring to a painting which has been placed behind her of Elwood and Harvey. I guess the painter could see Harvey? Or Elwood painted it himself, perhaps? We never really talk about that. So that's kind of a way to have that cake and eat it too, but apparently one suggestion that was made, and I don't think this is canonical, but it's interesting, and it relates to something we were talking about. Apparently, there was some idea to, at the end of the film, that cab driver who, like, gave that speech and convinced the sister that she shouldn't force Elwood to take a drug and change his whole personality, that by the end of the film, we would see that that cab driver had a bunny tail. And maybe that cab driver was Harvey all along.
No.
I don't think you need that. I think that that's wrapping things up too tidily. Mm-hmm. Like that fits in a plot way, but it actually doesn't fit in a thematic way, because we need to believe that Elwood, being a good the way he is, happy the way he is, benevolent the way he is, that he doesn't need help.
Yeah.
And that the world is better off with him as is. We need to believe that the world wants that, not Harvey.
Okay.
We need to believe that the world is better off for that. And if that sells much better if just some random person shares their opinion than if we find out it was all some trickster scheme by a pooka.
Yeah. No, I hate that.
Yeah,
that's a terrible idea.
I agree. And I'm glad they shot that down, because that does not work at all. Mm. So yeah, that is Harvey. It's a very light film, but it's not a very slight film. Like, there's actually like a lot of stuff to really consider here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very, very happy I rewatched it. Apparently there is a made-for-TV version from the 70s, also starring James Stewart.
Oh, kidding.
In which James Stewart actually thinks his performance was better.
In the 70s version?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I need to check that out at some point.
All right.
But yeah, who can say? It would be like, you know, like, hey, we did like 800 shows of this on the stage, and you recorded the 799th, but I thought 633 was my best. Like, it's whatever. I guess he's allowed that opinion. I don't know. Maybe he is better. But that's that. Last thoughts?
Just a small word on how... We've talked about how it's not, you just said it's not slight. We talked about how it deals with some pretty heady issues, but in a light way, without making light of the seriousness.
Mm-hmm.
And how curiously engrossing the film is. The speech near the end of the movie where Elwood talks about meeting Harvey for the first time, you can see that on stage. Where they're in the alleyway behind the bar, and he's talking about how he met Harvey for the first time.
That would work on stage.
Work just fine on stage. And it's you're wrapped by this amazing scene, that Jimmy, this great performance and this wonderful speech. It's rare that a film that is so talky will grab you in such a way.
It's a talky film about the fantastic.
Yeah.
It can't show you anything, really. It only can talk about it.
Would you have liked? Would you have been okay with it if all the other characters exit, and there's something where like Jimmy Stewart's walking away, and we like briefly see Harvey, or we like see a silhouette or a shadow?
We see Harvey's physical influence. We see like a door open at some point, and we see that he has a hat that he left behind. Apparently, if you leave the hat behind, you can see it. Like we know
it says F. Krueger on the inside.
I know he's real. The movie doesn't pretend he's not real.
Yeah,
I think the movie, if you want to not believe it, you can. You can have that interpretation, but I think the movie pretty much comes down on the idea of he's real.
Yeah,
only Elwood can see him, and the fact that only Elwood can see him is infuriating because you can't know, and you can understand why this is annoying for everybody. Right. Whether you're charmed by Elwood,
you're jealous.
I think jealousy is perfectly valid here, but like, or if he's annoying to you, because this would totally get your goat too. I think if we could see him, it would hurt that. I think having that little bit where it's like, this is only for Elwood.
Yeah.
Is sweet. But I think it helps the theme of the film, where you are basically, you are being asked to take Harvey on faith, aren't you?
Yep.
It's like some guy, there's some fucking guy down the street who builds houses for a living, walks over and just says, hey, by the way, God talked to me. Turns out I'm his son. Anyway, be nice to each other. And you're like, whoa, wait, what the fuck? And the guy's like, yeah, just God's my dad. Anyway, that's not important. The important thing is everyone should be nice to each other. I agree that everyone should be nice with each other, but I'm getting really wrapped up in this thing you're saying right now. And it's like, no, forget it. Be nice. Oh, okay.
Oh, shoot, that kid broke his leg. Here, it's cured. I fixed it by touching it.
No, it is a Christ allegory in a lot of ways, and if people just don't know what to do with him, and they want to like shut him up or whatever like that. They don't realize is that the possibility of the fantastic and that leading us to some form of enlightenment, which I think Elwood has achieved. Yeah. Maybe it's not the most productive form of enlightenment. He doesn't seem to be getting a lot done with his day, but he certainly does seem to have approached some form of nirvana, doesn't he?
His existence in the world is making it a better place.
Yeah.
Everybody he talks to is better off for having met him.
In a very, very light way, but still. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something to that. And so, yeah, for me, Harvey is one of the better Christ movies. I think because of that. Because I'm expected to take this absolutely absurd thing on faith.
Yeah.
And by the end of the film, I do.
I would say it's a little bit more of a Buddhist allegory about sort of the traveling, well, I guess Christ as well, the people who sort of dispense parables and give lessons. And
I think they're closely related in terms of like the way that their narrative is told.
Christ, when you look at sort of Christ's life, he was, you know, angry a lot. He was a firebrand and he was upturning tables and stuff. You know, politically dangerous. Buddha is typically seen in depictions of Buddha as a laughing figure.
Well, one could look at Harvey as a story in which Christ narrowly avoided the passion.
He was
betrayed by his closest.
If Christ
the person closest
grew
to him,
to old age and got to continue to spread the word.
His sister betrays him.
Uh-huh.
And tries to throw him to the wolves. And he narrowly avoids it just by luck. It's almost a Monty Python routine.
The disciples are all the guys in the bar.
Yeah.
Like, who just sort of hang out in the bar with him. It's like, yeah, we know Harvey's there.
Yeah, basically,
He's pretty cool.
Yeah. I like this. I do. It's actually become one of my favorite Christ. Like, this and The Last Temptation of Christ. Two of my favorite Christ movies. Anyway, that is it for Critically Reclaimed this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Hope you enjoyed the show. A little later / earlier than usual. Just because of scheduling things. But we'll be back really, really soon. And we have another poll for you to take part in.
As we do every week.
Our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. At any tier, even $1 a month, get to vote for every episode of Critically Reclaimed. And your options this week, All Hail from Paramount Plus. Remember them? Remember that? That's a thing. They don't just have Star Trek, but they might as well. And our options are mostly older films, kind of kooky films, but some not.
They have a really interesting film selection on Paramount Plus.
They really do. Let's real fast. One of them is called Bill and Coo, which is a film about two birds. They're real birds. It's not an animated film.
It's in record books. I think it might even be in the Guinness Book of one of the only films made with a mostly avian cast, which is a weird honor to have. There it is.
The cast is accredited to Jimmy the Crow. It's one of the crows. Anyway, I digress. It's a bird movie. It won an Oscar for being a bird movie. The feathered this is the description on IMDb. The feathered residents of Chirpendale are terrorized by an evil crow. There you go.
Chirpendale.
Next up, we have DOA, which of course means I can't think of a funny acronym. It means Dead on Arrival.
Dead on Arrival.
It's Dead or Alive.
That joke
the action
was DOA
movie.
As well.
Hey-oh. DOA is a classic film noir.
Yes.
starring Edmund O'Brien. It's about a guy who is actually very similar to the movie Crank, if you've seen it. It's a guy who's been poisoned, only has a couple of days to live, and he's got to figure out who killed him. Boy, is that an exciting premise. Always has been. Next up, we have a film called GOG. No, I didn't just, choke a little bit.
DOA, GOG.
There you go. It's GOG.
It's Killer Robot.
Ooh.
It's a robot movie. A robot, it's gonna, sabotage a space launch. And,
ooh, that's exciting.
Yeah.
We're all gonna have a good time with that. And then lastly, we have a horror film starring Vincent Price and Christopher Lee, based somewhat loosely on the works of Edgar Allan Poe, called The Oblong Box. Which is about a guy who's been keeping his brother prisoner in a tower, and he escapes, and it's all creepy, and I think someone gets buried alive at some point. It is the first film to co-star Vincent Price and Christopher Lee. So those are your options. We'll review one of those on next week's program, or this week's program, I guess. The next program, anyway. And thank you, everybody, for listening. We are really, really, really appreciative of you, and we just think you're great.
Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of got lost train of thought. Anyway, thank you. Special thank you to all of our patrons, without whom we wouldn't exist. If you're not a patron, you want to be. We have a lot of exclusive shows available for you. Huge back catalogs of content over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. Commentary tracks, shows about Batman, the Academy Awards, Star Trek, tons of Star Trek. Oh, my God. We got old podcasts about movies that aren't on Disney Plus but are supposed to be. We got old podcasts about Firefly and made-for-TV movies. Tons of stuff over there at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. If you want to join in the conversation, you want to talk about anything we discussed on this show, a couple ways to do that. The best way to do that is to email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email on an upcoming episode of our podcast, We've Got Mail. Whitney, what is our P.O. box for people who prefer P.O. boxes?
If you want to send us an actual piece of physical letter, mail, that'd be great. You can send it to P.O. box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah. We're also on Twitter, @CriticAcclaim. I am @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
And that's about that. Until next time, we still don't know how to end this podcast.